Once wandering northward early in the summer of 1864, I came upon a ruined one-and-a-half-story farmhouse by the banks of a stream. The house itself, burnt out and long since emptied of all valuables, was practically roofless and so full of holes as to be useless as shelter against the elements. But behind it stood a greenhouse whose remaining glass shingles glittered gray-brown in the sunlight like river mud. Inside it I found only a faded red pots, mostly broken, a few still containing a rich, stinking black soil into which all vegetable matter in the structure had long ago disintegrated. Two-thirds of the panes had fallen from the roof and walls, and lay on the floor in jumbled shards that crunched beneath my boots with each shifting of my weight. A scratching and clicking like those of a squirrel's claws against glass made me glance upward at the ceiling, through which I saw gazing placidly down at me the lovely, spectral face of a woman. Badly startled, I slipped and fell backwards against a potting table, which saved my hands being cut by the slivered glass on the floor. Leaning on it with my elbows, I looked timorously back up to find the transparent lady still staring at me, her wistful smile as faint and pretty as condensed breath on the pane, tendering grace and unearned absolution. It was a moment before I took note of her neighbor to the left, a seated man in a top hat, or the elderly couple to her right. As my brain digested this new information, the lady transformed before my eyes from ectoplasm to ambrotype, her fading emulsion struck by the sun's rays at the precise acute angle required to create the illusion of a positive image. The sheet was about 10 by 12 inches in size, and unusual in that the photographer had made a very close composition of the lady's head, his depth of focus so shallow that only her lips and eyes were sharp, her nose, ears, throat, and collar all softened into an indistinct haze. All the other shingles still in place proved to be discarded, backless ambrotypes also. And carefully picking up from the ground a sliver of a broken one as curved and sharp as a scimitar, I was able to distinguish a sloppily knotted cravat and the lapels of a coat cut in a manner no longer fashionable. I had no particular knowledge of photography then, but I knew the stories of battlefield photographers cutting window panes from their frames in abandoned houses for use as plates. This was, I suppose, the civilian householder's revenge on the vandalizing photographers, letting the sun slowly bake their hard work back into clear, unadorned glass sheets. I had earlier entertained the notion of sleeping in the dilapidated house, but despite the lady's beauty and benevolent aspect, the idea of spending the night in a place that produced phantoms in daylight made me uneasy, and I continued on down the road.
Scott Phillips is the author of the pulp noir novels The Ice Harvest and The Walkaway. His new novel is Cottonwood, a sprawling, sordid story set in Kansas in the post-Civil War era. Welcome to Fine Print, Scott.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, mystery comes in all sorts of shades. There's a spectrum that might start on one end with the hardcore pulp, go to the noir, to the American detective story, to the drawing room, to the cozy. Mm-hmm. Where do you find yourself in that spectrum?
Oh, I guess the noir. I like a lot of pulp writing, too. I like a lot of older pulp writing. It's sort of a disappearing art form, although there are people still practicing it in a different way. I mean, there are people still publishing a lot of books a year, a lot of paperback originals, but you know, it's not like it was in the old days. But you know, Jim Thompson's and those guys I like a lot, and I think probably that's about where I fall.
Could you talk about the language that you use? It's very controlled and very specific, and I'm really interested in whether it just comes out of you naturally or whether you really work at it.
Well, I work at it. This book sounds a lot different from the other two, because it's set in the 19th century and the narrator is a 19th century character. And of course that changes the way the character has to sound. I got a lot of his voice, to tell you the truth, from original 19th century documents. I avoided scrupulously reading modern day people who were doing the same things as I did with this book. Books like Charles Portis's True Grit and Thomas Berger's Little Big Man, because I didn't want to latch on to somebody else's approximation of a 19th century voice. I was afraid of doing that. But for this one, I think the one writer whose voice influenced me the most on this was a writer named Jack Black, who published a book in the 20s called You Can't Win, which is still in print. And I'm always telling people about it because it's one of the greatest books I've ever read. It's his memoir of being a burglar. When he wrote it, he was the librarian for the San Francisco Call. He had been the publisher of that paper had sort of rescued him from jail and given him a job. He was too old to be in jail, you know, and so he wrote this wonderful memoir of being a burglar and a sneak thief in the 1880s and 90s. And I love the voice of that book so much that I think I picked up a little bit of his tone.
Tell us a little bit about Cottonwood, where it's coming from, because it's an interesting novel with a mystery that kind of rises up from the sediment of the character's experience.
Well, Cottonwood, the crimes in Cottonwood are based on a real family of criminals called the Benders, also known as the Hellbenders and the Bloody Benders. They were a family, or they may not have been. Nobody really knows where they came from, but it has long been assumed that they were a family. They posed as a family anyway. There were two older, an older couple and a younger man and a younger woman, and they had a house out on the Kansas prairie. And they all invited people to come and have meals with them and pass through. And when someone was local, they would just, you know, feed them a meal and let them be on their way. If the person traveling was not known to them, they would invite them to spend the night, and they would dispatch them with a hammer and then slit their throats. And they buried about 15 people back in their orchard behind the house. And it took about 3 years for them to be found out. And when they were found out, they made their escape. And no one really knows if they escaped or not, because there have long been stories. In fact, there were deathbed confessions in the 20s from men who told their families that they had been on that posse and that they had caught the Benders and killed them and kept the money. So I'd always been fascinated by that story, and I wanted to weave it into a novel. I didn't want to do that as the whole basis of a novel, but I wanted to weave that into the story of a town in that period, the 1870s and 80s.
Bill Ogden is a really fascinating character, and his life and his voice is so different from what you'd expect of somebody of that time period. And the story is entertainingly sordid. I wonder if you'd talk about the sordid aspects of this story.
Well, you know, if you go back through, you know, and read Western history, there's a lot of ribald stuff back then, and there's a lot of sordid stuff there. You know, you read old newspapers, and you know, the Wild West was wild in more ways than one. Particularly in these boom towns, I mean, there were a lot of people, a lot of men, and very few women. And the women who did come very often came as prostitutes, and you know, it was a wild and woolly place. And you know, reading these original stories, going back and reading people's firsthand accounts and reading old newspapers, you know, there's a lot that you don't get in old Western movies and in most Western novels. There's a lot of, you know, I keep telling people that one of my goals with this book was to show people that the old West wasn't just violence. There was a lot of sex, too.
One thing I found really fascinating in your book is so many Westerns, and our impression of so many Westerns, involves a lot of nobility and moral strength. In this book, nobility is in very short supply.
Yeah.
You'd have to spot it with a microscope or a magnifying glass.
Well, another thing about the Old West, I think that's you can find looking at the historical record, is that really what people were mostly out there for, and they weren't bad people, but they were mostly out there trying to earn a living. I mean, I think people went out there because they thought there was a better living to be made than there was back east, or, you know, back in Germany or wherever they were from. So the issue of nobility, You know, it does come up in the course of storytelling, but I think in reality, you know, there's the old question I've always found interesting about Wyatt Earp. People, there's this controversy among Western buffs about whether Wyatt Earp was this, you know, fascist who represented the federal government and, you know, the sort of the equivalent of the guy in the black helicopter today, or whether he was this noble knight, you know, bringing law and order to the Old West. And I think that there's an element of truth in both of those. And but I think really what Wyatt Earp was a guy who came out west to make money. Wyatt Earp, you know, for example, he in Tombstone, Arizona, owned a casino and he owned a silver mine. And he wanted people to come out to Tombstone and live. And the fact that people were jumping claims and rustling cattle made it hard to attract people and therefore made it hard for him to earn a living. And I think that was the motivation of a lot of people in the Old West. They were out there trying to make a living, and woe unto anybody who stood in their way.
The economics of cottonwood are pretty fascinating. There's a big time scam going that starts the whole town.
Right, that this guy arrives from Chicago and says, "Well, there's a cattle trail that's going to come through here. You know, the railroad is coming already. They know that." But this guy comes and says, "Well, the reason the railroad is coming is because there's going to be a cattle depot. I'm going to open a, you know, I'm gonna, there's going to be a, we're going to open this this these we're going to start these cattle pens, and we're going to, this trail is going to come up here from Texas." Well, it's nonsense. He's really trying to do this, but it's not going to work because it's way too far east for a cattle trail to make any sense, you know. And so, but nobody sees that. Everybody just sees the dollar signs floating in the air, and so they go nuts. And all these people start arriving, construction crews, and money starts pouring in. Real money starts pouring in because people see this starting to happen. And part of this was inspired by the fact that my wife worked for a dot-com. And one morning we went from being sort of rich on paper to the company not even existing. And I thought, you know, there's an analogy here to what happened in a lot of little towns back in the Old West. You know, there were these bubbles that, you know, popped up, and they have these really rich little towns, and then suddenly, bam, you know, somebody would open up another cattle depot, or the mine would, you know, the vein would tap out. And suddenly the town was just you know, two old drunks and the mayor. And so I thought that would be kind of an interesting thing to play with in a book.
Could you tell us a little bit about the pettiness of your characters in this and your other novels? We can talk about Cottonwood first, but talk about how petty these people are. They're very self-involved.
Well, people are, though, I think.
They are.
They are. Well, they're not all terribly petty, but they're all they all have their own self-interest at heart, and they tend to be looking out for their own welfare first and foremost, and they come at, you know, they end up at cross purposes with each other. And that to me is that leads to drama and comedy also, because, you know, these people are often just arguing about, you know, about very minor, trivial, stupid things, and that's I happen to find that funny, so except when it turns violent.
Well, you do have a great sense of humor, and that's one of the other things I thought distinguished Cottonwood, is it's very funny, and it has a there's a constant feeling of humor bubbling through it. It doesn't take itself seriously, although it does give you a feeling that you're really getting a accurate picture of this era.
Well, I like to think of it as sort of whistling through the graveyard in a way. I like a yeah, I like a book to be funny. I think that's one of the things. I had Jim Burke, James Lee Burke, as a creative writing teacher 20 some years ago in at Wichita State, and one of the things he told me that really stuck with me is he said, you know, being funny is a good, because I was writing funny light stuff at the time, and he said, you know, being funny is a great tool. You don't want it to be all you're doing necessarily, but, you know, getting a reader to laugh is a great way to hook them. And, you know, you can get your other stuff in under the radar when you're when you got the reader laughing.
One other aspect, of course, and this works through, again through all your work, is a kind of hardcore open sexuality, but it's not sensuous. It's kind of ugly.
Well, I don't think it's ugly. It's I don't think of it that way anyway. It's just they're fairly matter of fact. There's this thing that they give in England called the Bad Sex Award, and it's for the worst description of the sexual act in a novel. And you read them, and they're from good, oftentimes they're from very good books, but these people try to write, very often I think good writers get sidetracked by trying to write very lyrical descriptions of sex. And so in my descriptions of sex, I try to be a little bit mechanical. And in this case, there is a love story in this book, and there was a love story in my last book too that I think is the heart of the book. I think, in fact, my last book, The Walkaway, really is a love story. It's about this man who walks away from a nursing home, and all he wants to do is get back with his wife. I mean, that's the core of the book to me, is that this guy has been, in love with this woman for 50 years. And there is love in these books, but when it's the kind of sex that one would want to be lyrical about, I just don't have the characters talk about it. Because I don't think people really talk about that kind of sex. People tend to talk about, I think people talk more graphically about casual sex than they do about sex that means something to them. And when you're trying to describe something as sublime as sex with someone that you love, it's really hard to do. But whereas you're talking about, for example, in Cottonwood, there are several sexual encounters with, he has a sexual encounter with his landlady, and that's pretty graphically described. And, they're friends and they're having, a sexual encounter. And, but it doesn't mean that much to either one of them. And whereas this woman that he loves, Maggie, who at that point in the book he has lost and has gone away, he never describes sex with her. He describes going up the stairs with her, and he describes the feeling he has afterward. But I just don't feel like the character would ever discuss it.
No, that's very interesting. Let's talk a little bit about your first book, The Ice Harvest.
Okay.
It's an interesting, to me, it struck me as very much a pulp novel.
That was my intention, yeah.
And it's very fun. I think that the publisher missed a great opportunity to have a girl on a pole on the front cover.
Yeah. Well, some of the publishers did that overseas. There are things like that.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah, well, some pretty graphic stuff overseas.
The feel of that novel, it's 24 hours with the worst version of a trial lawyer that you could ever imagine.
Very sleazy lawyer. The worst kind.
Could you talk about the contrast between his experience and when the novel takes place, which is Christmas Eve?
Well, it comes from a few Christmases I had when I was a little alienated and alone, and I lived in France for a long time, and at Christmas time I tended to feel sort of excluded because I didn't have family over there, and I didn't have it seemed like Christmas was sort of happening without me, and I thought that was kind of interesting. I thought this would be an interesting thing to do with a guy in his own hometown, somebody who has so alienated everybody who loves him that Christmas for him is something that he sees happening all around him, but something he's not participating in. And I liked the idea of him sort of wandering around and experiencing this holiday that everybody else is just obsessed with, and you can't get away from the songs and the tinsel, but it's still something he's not really, he's at arm's length from it.
The language in this novel is simple, and the plot is very straightforward. It is just a 24-hour slice.
Right.
Could you talk about how you came up up with that. And also the time setting too is fairly fascinating. 1979. What made you pick that time period?
Well, it was a time that I knew. I was about, let's see, I guess I was 18 years old in 1979. And I had a pretty good sense of what 1979 felt like, you know, and I remembered that year pretty well. Also, I didn't want it to be too modern. For one thing, because the strip clubs had changed. You know, I used to go to these clubs with a friend of mine named Ben Urish, who is now one of the world's leading authorities on burlesque. And he teaches at University of Michigan. And he used to take me. He used to drag me to these places, actually. And, uh-huh. You know, and he'd say, "Well, we got to go to the 49 and Go-Go because the county's going to be shutting all these places down next week." You know, and they never did. But you know, we would go out, and they were very dingy, sleazy, poorly lit places. And I think that that just all changed later on. I think that all got it got a little slicker. I mean, even in kind of cheap places, they had to get a little slicker and a little nicer because there was so much competition from above. And I wanted to maintain that sense of just cut rate sleaze, like the kind of place you could just open up in a, you know, an empty storefront, you know, and just put a table in there and have somebody dance.
One thing I really liked about this novel was the language, in particular the creative cursing. Now, we can't read a lot of this
right,
on the radio, but we can talk about
it. I used all of the seven words.
Yes.
Plus some.
Yeah, you made a few up. Could you talk about the creative deployment of expletives, how you do that, and how it plays into the humor of this novel?
Well, I've had a lot of criticism, mostly from friends of my mother's, about my use of language. I love to hear people curse in a creative way, and particularly, I think there's a whole school of profanity that is sort of disappearing because it's becoming so much a part of everyday discourse. I love the way people used to talk, and you know, I'll occasionally hear some really obscure expression, and I'll write it down. You know, I'll hear somebody talking, and you know, I'll write something down. Generally, from older people. I don't think too many people talk like that anymore, but I really love that, and I don't use it indiscriminately. In fact, I find myself cutting a lot of it because I don't like, you know, I don't like it to feel like it's just people spewing out obscenities because they, you know, it's just they don't know any other words. But you know, when somebody's really mad or when somebody's expressing contempt, I think there's nothing like a good epithet.
I'm wondering if you could talk about plot. The plot of The Ice Harvest is linear, and mm-hmm. the plot of Cottonwood and the plot of The Walkaway, they're both layered.
Mm. Well, part of that is because Ice Harvest is a very simply structured book. It's, as you say, it's 24 hours in the, or a little bit less than 24 hours in the life of this lawyer. And he's trying to get out of town, and there's some money that he's needs to get a hold of before he goes out of town. And he's not sure really who his friends are anymore. And that's basically, you know, in a nutshell, that's the plot. And I like that kind of plot. I like that kind of simple, simple story. The Walkaway got real complicated. In fact, to the point where some people didn't like the book because they thought it was too complicated. It had a story that was set in 1952 and a story that was set in 1989. And the stories were intertwined and interrelated. It was based on a true story from Wichita. In the late 40s, early 50s, there were these sex lotteries at the aircraft plants.
Sex lotteries?
Sex lotteries, yes.
And what did you win in a sex lottery?
Well, what you won was a weekend in a cabin with all the steak you could eat, all the whiskey you could drink, and the company of the two women who ran the raffle.
Really?
And yeah, they were operating it on the shop floor, apparently, at least one, and I think three of the aircraft plants. And it was exposed by the Wichita Beacon by this wonderful reporter named Ernie Warden, who was just a real interesting character. And I found that story so fascinating that I wanted to, I always wanted to put it in a book. And so but that gets layered in, and that happens in the 50s, and it reverberates into the late 80s. And so the basic stimulus of the plot is this old man, Gunther, this policeman, walks away from a nursing home, and he has a form of senile dementia. His memory is imperfect. He remembers the distant past very well, but the more recent past is a little vaguer for him. And he's wandering away looking for this money that he hid a long time ago, so that his wife can move into the nursing home with him. And what he doesn't realize is that his wife has spent all that money keeping him in the nursing home. So it's a very complicated book, and I think I juggle those stories pretty well. But it is a more complicated plot than I would want to work with again, I think. I see Cottonwood as being fairly simple. He falls in love. The narrator falls in love with this woman who's come to town. He goes into business with the woman's husband. The Bloody Benders are found out. Their crimes are discovered. And Bill ends up having to leave town for a while. And some years later, he returns. And to me, that, I guess it just seems simple to me compared to the last one. I had a lot less juggling to do.
Now, all three of your novels are connected, aren't they?
Yeah, they're all connected in strange ways, yeah. And the one I'm working on now is connected to all of them, too.
That was my next question. Could you tell us a little bit about it and when we can expect it?
Well, I think it'll be about a year and a half, probably, maybe a little more. It's a story set in the Depression, 1930s, and it's set partially in Hollywood and partially in Cottonwood. And its main character is Bill Ogden's grandson, who is an alligator wrestler.
Okay. Wow, that sounds quite fun. Now, I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about some of the people in the mystery business, because some of the people I know you work with and some of your publishers.
They're awful people.
How about your publisher, Dennis McMillan?
Well, Dennis came to me about 4 years ago. I had finished this book, and Dennis wanted to bring out a small edition of The Ice Harvest, and I didn't have a publisher at that time, and so I said, "Yeah, sure," and so he started spreading the word, and before long, I had an offer from New York, but it was incumbent on Dennis not doing his edition, and I called Dennis up, and I said, "Well, look, you know, I'm not going to welch on our deal, but I just wanted you to know I have this deal in New York," which was basically thanks to Dennis. And Dennis said, "Well, that's all right. I'll tell you what, just give me a small portion of the advance and we'll call it even." So Ballantyne brought the book out, but Dennis brought out a beautiful limited edition, which is just a gorgeous book. Designed by Michael Kellner, who I think is probably the best book designer in America, along with Chip Kidd. I mean, he's really, really brilliant. And he's done all three. He's done limiteds of all three of my books. Dennis has, with Michael doing the designing. So,
now, are you here for Left Coast Crime?
I am here for Left Coast Crime.
Tell us a little bit about that conference.
Well, it's a conference of crime writers and readers and other professionals, editors and agents, etc. Walter Mosley this year is the guest of honor, And I forget who else is coming. I know David Corbett from the Bay Area. You have David Corbett and Eddie Muller are both going to be there. Kent Harrington and a friend of ours from New York, Chris Niles, who's a very wonderful crime writer. And I don't know who else is going to be there. Barry Eisler, I think.
Now, one question, I wanted to get back to was the idea of your fiction. Even though you write in the noir and the pulp idiom, your work also seems to be very firmly historical fiction.
Yes, sometimes it is. I discovered when I was writing The Walk Away that I liked doing historical research. It started with when I realized I was going to set part of it in the 50s, I started doing research for, well, how much did a Plymouth cost, a used Plymouth? Because I had this guy buying a car, and I started doing other things. I started getting old newspapers and classified ads, and a friend of mine named Jerry K. Smith, who works at the Wichita Eagle, would send me old classified ads from that period. And so when I started doing this one, as a Western, I started doing a lot of historical research, and I found that I really, really liked it. In fact, the research kind of got in the way of the writing a little bit because I really was more interested in going to the library and finding more stuff. And things like I had him coming back to Kansas from San Francisco by train, and so I had to find out every I had to find out this train schedules, and I had to find out what the train cars were like, and did all this typical kind of research. And I probably spent 2 weeks on it, and I probably bought $150 worth of books about trains. And then in the end, I cut it all out because it was just I didn't need who cares if he's on the train? We know he came by train, so I just had him arriving, but that stuff is fun to do, and I think the book is still better for it somehow, even though that stuff's not in there. I think there's just a sense that
It really
you're
helps
not
in the,
winging it,
yeah, it helps in the world creation. You really create the world, and I think readers sense this stuff in the background.
Well, Jim Crumley once said, and this is one of the best things I ever heard about writing character, he said, "You should always know what your character's grandparents did for a living. You don't need to put it in the book, but you should know." And I really think that helps. There's a lot of stuff that you end up using, and you may end up mentioning something like that, or you may not, but it's good to have it in the back of your mind. It keeps the characters consistent, I think.
Tell us a little bit about how you started writing.
I started writing when I was a kid. I started writing, just silly stuff, Twilight Zone kind of stories. And I always had good, I have to say, I had a few bad teachers in my day, but I never ever had a bad English teacher. I always had good English teachers, and they always encouraged me, to a one, they all encouraged me to keep writing. So I wrote as an adult, even when I wasn't, even trying to make a living at it. I just kept it up, and I always took it seriously. And Jim Burke, as I mentioned, was my one of my I had freshman comp, in fact, from Jim Burke, in addition to
Wow.
creative writing. And he always, he takes it very, very seriously. And that was something he passed on to me. I think he treats it as a vocation. So I kept doing it. I didn't know that I would ever, be writing novels for my living, but I always took it seriously enough that I think it improved my work because I didn't allow myself to slack.
When you're writing in this genre that you write in, and in general, in the world of historical fiction, there's always a lot of interest in movies. Have your books been sold as movies, or?
Well, the first one has. The first one, Focus, which is a division of Universal, has the rights to. And I don't really know what is happening with that right now. Things change about every 5 minutes, so I hope someday they will make it. Cottonwood, unfortunately, has so many characters in it from The Ice Harvest that it's considered a sequel, even though I don't think of it as a sequel. But it's got so many characters from it that it's considered a sequel, so I can't sell it to anybody but universal focus. So nothing happened with that. It's also sort of unfilmable, I think.
You mean, you said Cottonwood?
Oh, so not Cottonwood, sorry, The Walkaway.
The Walkaway.
Is what I meant.
Right.
And it's sort of, I think it's sort of unfilmable. And Cottonwood is right now being read by various different people to see if anybody wants to make it. So, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, they're hard things to do. Ice Harvest is an easy one.
Right, and it's straightforward.
Yeah. And The Walkaway is impossible, and I think Cottonwood is slightly less impossible, I hope.
So your approach to Hollywood is of the go to the California border, throw
that's
it across, and wait for the sack of money?
The old Hemingway thing, yeah, exactly. That's it. Although I've had a good experience with the movies, I have to say. When I wrote a movie, in fact, a few years ago, which was such a frustrating experience that I ended up writing Ice Harvest. I hadn't written any fiction in a while, and I'd written some screenplays, and I wrote one that got made. And, you know, it wasn't my story. There was nothing wrong with it. It was just, it wasn't my story, and it wasn't, you know, I worked on it with a wonderful novelist named Dave Maisel, M-A-S-I-E-L, who wrote a great book called 2182 Kilohertz.
And that was the movie was called?
No, the movie was called, that's just Dave's, no, I'm giving Dave a plug there. The movie was called Crosscut, and we were given the story, and we wrote it with the director, a man named Paul Raimondi. And, you know, it just wasn't my thing. It wasn't, so afterward I thought I'm just going to write something for my own amusement. But Ice Harvest has been a very good experience in terms of movies because it was adapted by Richard Russo and Robert Benton. And it's a terrific script. It's very good. It's very, very faithful to the book. Probably more faithful to the book than I would have been, you know, if I'd adapted it. You know, so we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens.
We've been speaking with Scott Phillips. His latest novel is Cottonwood. Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for having me.